Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you joining me for a little bit of baseball card talk as we are going through one of the busiest years in the history of Major League Baseball, the centennial season for Major League Baseball, 1969. So we look at 69 tops and our random poll, rather appropriate, and this was random, by the way, but when you talk about the 1969 season, almost always you think of the New York Mets and their miracle World Series run. And of course, we have the one and only Cleon Jones as our random pull card number 512 from the colorful but not all that creative set from Topps that season. In my opinion, very similar to 1967, although I think it's better than the 67 Topps set. We'll get into the details of that in just a little bit. Also, when you talk about the 1969 season, you have to talk about the Major League expansion. So we'll dip our toe into that just a little bit because the 69 Major League Baseball expansion was an absolute debacle. And you could blame it all on Charlie Finley. Yes, the Oakland Athletics owner, for leaving Kansas City for Oakland. That kind of sped up the process and created a group of four teams that really three of them struggled to find their footing. One of them, the Kansas City Royals, was able to get out the gate a little better. But yeah, you can blame Charlie O pretty much for the 1969 expansion, an expansion that is best remembered for a lot of empty seats in some stadiums and a team that lasted just 1 year, that of course being the Seattle Pilots. So we'll discuss that. Also, we had our first auction break. We'll tell you more about that after we listen to you. First, let's talk about what you're talking about on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. A lot of things being discussed on our Twitter feed, including our last podcast on 1968 Topps, one of my favorite sets, even though a lot of other collectors will disagree with me. But if there's one thing we can all agree on, our random pull, Ed Brinkman, was a very underrated shortstop, somebody who did very well for the Washington Senators, as he was pictured in this particular Topps card, Topps number 49. And even though he was very much under the radar, he was still appreciated by most notably Billy Martin, his manager in Detroit and Texas later on in his career, but also a lot of other fans and co-workers of certain teams. One of our followers, Ted Ziegler, noted, "He was one of my dad's favorites." And Ted's dad, if I did my research correctly, was a trainer for the Texas Rangers, so he would certainly know Ed Brinkman real well, an all-star and gold glove shortstop. And like I mentioned, Billy Martin was a big fan of Ed Brinkman in Detroit because you had Brinkman and Aurelio Rodriguez on the left side of the infield. And Martin even said in his autobiography, number one, that there wasn't a whole lot of ground balls getting through the infield, certainly on the left side, as he was able to make Ed Brinkman a key part of that Detroit team that kind of revived their playoff hopes, even though Brinkman suffered a back injury in the 1972 playoffs and really couldn't contribute to the Tigers' success as they fell to Oakland in five games. But thank you very much for checking in, Teb, who was named after former Washington Senator and Texas Ranger manager Ted Williams. Now, we also had a nice little flame war on Wax and Gum Stains when talking about our Flashback Friday edition. I posted the link to our podcast on the 87 Fleer set, and I've always liked 87 Fleer, and our random pull was Kent Tekulve. We'll talk about him in a little bit, but whenever you talk about baseball cards in 1987, whether you like the set or not, the first set you think of is 87 Topps. Whenever I say 1987 baseball cards, that's it. You think of Topps, you think of the wood grain design, you think of all the big rookies that were in that set. But the 87 Fleer set was nothing to sneeze at. In fact, it is a very classy, sharp set, and one that just doesn't quite get enough attention because it's overshadowed by Topps. Even Donruss in 87 put out a pretty good set that year. So I posted, I think it was the first tweet that we sent out promoting the Flashback Friday episode, and it said that it was lost in the popularity of 87 Tops, the equally awesome 87 Fleer set. So I found a couple of different points of view. Ben Adams says, not a bad set, but I don't think it's equal to 87 Tops. So I retweeted that. And of course, at the same time, Ben was commenting that he likes 87 Tops. Totally unrelated. Dave Michener says, let's be honest with ourselves. 87 Tops was hideous. Had 87 Fleer been my first set, I'd probably be goo-goo over it. It's prettier, but no memory. So we put that out there, and we had people picking sides there. You know, was Fleer better than Tops? Was Tops better than Fleer? And which order of preference do you have in the 1987 set? So some pretty good conversation going on about the 87 sets. And honestly, whether you like or hate 87 Tops, the 87 sets were all phenomenal. You could say the same for the 84 and 85 sets, but Fleer, Tops, and Donruss coming out with some really, really good sets in 1987. So you can still continue that conversation if you go to Wax and Gum Stains and scroll down the feed a little bit. You can latch on to the conversation and offer up your 2 cents. Now, as for Kent Tekulve, Beauty of a Game responds, Tekulve in anything but Pirates gear just looks wrong. And this was when Tekulve was with the cross-state rival Phillies. And he looks like, and I joke about this in the podcast, everybody has a picture in their family photo album like this Kent Tekulve card. Tekulve wearing the Phillies gear, it's a nice close-up of him kind of leaning on his knee, leaning forward. And he's, of course, wearing those smoky aviator glasses that he wore throughout much of his career. And he's still kind of got the sideburns going. He's still got the, well, he's got the dad look. And I joked about it in the podcast. I said, every family photo album has a picture, normally on vacation, of your dad striking a similar pose or looking like Kent Tekulve here. So Kent Tekulve with the ultimate dad picture represented on the 87 Fleer card. Frank Smith chiming in about Tekulve. I remember me and my dad saw him get out of his station wagon before a game in those days. And that also goes to show how times have changed so much that Kent Tekulve, who was just one of the best relievers in the game, and of course had that wicked, deceptive sidearm throw, mostly with the Pittsburgh Pirates, but again, you know, a little bit with the Phillies near the end of his career. This is a guy who, you know, if he's playing today and if he's putting up the numbers they did back then, now, one of the top closers in the game for a good, 10 years, 12 years? A big reason why the Pirates were world champions in 1979. But he was driving a station wagon, just puttering around in that thing. So how cool is that? And speaking of how cool is Kent Tekulve, again, let's go back to the glasses. That's what Craig Mergenthal says. How about those shades? Nothing cooler than the smoky aviator glasses of Kent Tekulve, who is back with the Pirates organization. He's been scouting with them for a very long time. So even though Tekulve had the smoky aviator glasses, he was a beanpole too. He's a very tall, lanky guy, and he had that sidearm delivery wearing those black and gold pajama uniforms that the Pirates did back in the We Are Family days in the late 70s. Kind of funny to look at him back then, but he's still very much involved in Major League Baseball nowadays. So that is very cool. So if you have any comments about any of the podcast or any of the players that we talk about or just anything about the hobby, you know, we covered it all with that quick scan through our Twitter feed. Wax and Gum Stains, it's open 24/7. You're more than welcome to carry on the conversation or start a conversation there. And make sure you share Wax and Gum Stains with your friends. Again, I implore you, let your friends, even if they don't collect nowadays, but they collected way back then, let them know about it, because we have a great time just talking about this great hobby of ours. Like I said, even if you don't really dabble in it that much now, but you know, looking back at some of the cards and some of the players from 20, 25, 30 years ago, it's always fun to go back in time and talk about these particular sets, and especially some of these vintage sets. I think we've hooked a few new vintage collectors. You're getting a good look at some of these older cards that maybe you didn't care much for because you were chasing those 89 Upper Deck Ken Griffey Juniors or the 91 Donruss Mo Vaughn cards. The big hits from back then, you were chasing the junk wax era stuff, and you forget about the vintage stuff. So if you're circling back into vintage and you're starting to collect because of this podcast, make sure you spread the word to other friends, because it's always good to be talking about this hobby. Again, even if you don't collect much now, if you're just looking back at some great nostalgia from through the years. Now, speaking of nostalgia and wax and gum stains, we held our first auction this past weekend. I offered up for my own personal collection a grocery rack pack of 1981 Tops, and we posted the video late yesterday. It took me a little while to get the video up there because it is a long video. It's about 11 minutes in length, but you know, you're going through 36 cards through this vintage set, or this vintage rack pack, I should say. So it's a little longer than any other wax or cello break that we do. But congratulations to Ben Adams for winning the auction. We had a pretty furious auction near the end. We set a 12 noon Eastern deadline on Sunday, and I decided to push it back an hour because we had four or five people really going at it with the auction. So finally, things settled down. Ben won the auction, and we went through the rack pack, and you see the pros and cons of some of these older packages. The 36-year-old rack pack has been passed down through a few hands and various boxes and shipping methods, I'm sure. And the way the Tops used to wrap those individual packs inside the rack pack works against itself these days. You know, the cellophane packaging was so tight on those cards, it didn't take much to bend some of the corners. So there are a few dinged corners on the cards that Ben got. But the good news is the cards that got a little rough-handed over the last 3.5 decades, those weren't really the most valuable cards. If you're looking for the big star cards, the biggest one was card number 700, the George Brett card with the AL All-Star banner at the bottom. So that's a nice find there. Also a Tony Pena rookie card and the Ferguson Jenkins card, which from a money standpoint, you're not going to get a lot for, but he is a Hall of Famer. It's always cool to get a Hall of Fame card out of a 36-year-old pack. So that was the first break that we did. If you like it, let me know. If you don't like it, well, let me know too. I'm not going to have my feelings hurt. But because we had a lot of interest in it, we had a lot of furious bidding for that 81 Tops grocery rack pack, I have gone out and ordered some new items to be opened up. So be on the lookout for that. I can't guarantee that we're going to do it every week, but I'm certainly going to try to make that the habit. And we'll just see how it goes over the summer, see if there's continued interest in doing these video breaks for the people that want to put up a few dollars for these items. Now, the next item up for bids, and I teased this in the video, and if you haven't seen the video, I'll share it with you now. Again, it comes from my own personal collection, and I waffled on this. I really thought about this over and over again because it's hard for me to part with this, but I can part with it because it's one pack of a lot of, I think, five that I bought a few years back. And I still have three of these packs. So if I lose one, I'm okay with it. And that is an unopened pack of 1977 Tops. So we will be putting that up for bid possibly this weekend. So be on the lookout, Wax and Gum Stains. We will put the notice out there, and we will handle it like we did the 81 Tops grocery rack pack. And that is, we will set a deadline. If you want to bid on the item, you can DM me. I follow pretty much everybody. So if I'm not following you and you want to take part in an auction, just send me a tweet and we'll make the adjustments on our end. But most everybody we follow. And basically, we'll set a minimum price for this, a starting price. And I will also, because it's a 77 Tops pack and it is a little scarce, I will set a threshold bid. It's not going to be too high. I don't think we're going to have any trouble eclipsing this bid. But we will have full details by the end of this week. And that is going to be a lot of fun, opening up that pack. Like I said, I've had it in my hands for, I want to say maybe 3 years, 4 years now. And it's always fun when you can open up a 40-year-old pack of baseball cards and just see what's inside of it. Even if you don't get any star players or any big rookie card, it's just kind of neat just kind of thumbing through those cards there. So that'll be our next item. And like I said, we do have a few other items on the way that we will be auctioning up over the next few weeks and doing some video breaks for. Now, if you would like to contribute to Wax Ecstatic, help fund not only the podcast, but the purchase of some of these items, you're more than welcome to leave a tip in our tip jar at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. That's where the auction bids go. The winning bidder will put the money there, but it is an open tip jar. So if you want to show your appreciation for this podcast that we do every Tuesday with new episodes and Flashback Friday episodes, and now these video breaks with some vintage product, you can do so again at paypal.me/waxecstatic. And it can be $2, it could be $20, it could be whatever you can afford. I appreciate every penny that comes through. And everybody who has already contributed, thank you, thank you, thank you. For those who haven't, please do consider it. As I've said before, I am not getting rich off of this podcast. I have never intended to get rich off of this podcast. I never intended for this podcast to be still running 10 months later, to be honest with you. But I have a lot of fun, and there are some production costs behind it. They're very small production costs, but any way we can cover those with the generosity of our listeners, I really, really appreciate it. So paypal.me/waxecstatic. All right, let's get into the 1969 top set. So much to discuss here, not only about the card, not only about a random pull Cleon Jones, but also the 1969 Major League Baseball expansion. And let's get into that first, because that kind of sets the stage for the 69 tops design, which is good, but not great, in my opinion. But there are a few things that I think make it stand out a little better than the 67 top set, which is another set I'm not a big fan of, although there are plenty of fans of the 67 top set. And same thing here, 69 tops, you either love it or you don't. There's not too much middle ground here. For me, I could pass on it, but now that I've bought a few vintage lots recently and I've thumbed through some of these cards, I'm starting to warm up to it just a little bit. And that's often the case with some of these vintage cards. You kind of blow them off years before, but then you take a really deep look at them, a second look, you go, okay, it's not as bad as I thought, but it's not as great as some of the other sets that we look at. So it all starts in 1969. Topps has to deal with another expansion. And as I mentioned in our podcast on 61 and 62 Topps, that really throws things off for the Topps company because, especially with 61 Topps, they had to play it really safe. They couldn't come up with a really great design. They couldn't do anything with team logos. There just wasn't a whole lot they could do because they didn't know what the Angels and the Senators logos were going to look like. They didn't know what the Minnesota Twins logo was going to look like because the old Senators had moved to Minnesota. So you had some pretty uninspiring photos. You had an uninspiring design. And a lot of went into the 61 set. Now in 62, Topps was able to up the ante. They came up with that very creative wood panel border with the picture kind of peeling off a little bit. So very similar to 87 Topps. So it was a little more creative, but again, they still had to kind of pull back a little bit because you didn't know what the New York Mets or the Houston Colt 45s logos were going to look like. You didn't know what players were going to be on there. So again, creativity, it wasn't all there. It was better than 61, but still they had to kind of pull back on the reins a little bit in terms of coming up with anything real wild and crazy. Well, the same thing would happen in 69, and Topps had a double whammy here because it wasn't just two teams that were coming into Major League Baseball. It was four teams. It was a massive expansion, and you can blame good old Charlie O, former owner of the Kansas City Athletics. Now, as I've said before, Charlie Finley had wanted his hands on a Major League Baseball team long before he owned the Athletics. In fact, going back to my reference of Bill Veeck's autobiography, Veeck as in Rec, and I discuss a lot about Bill Veeck in our 54 Tops podcast. Charlie O'Finley was an insurance salesman based out of Chicago. He actually tried to get the White Sox from Veeck, and Veeck had no interest in selling the team at the time. Finley was interested in getting a team out in L.A. before the Dodgers and Giants moved out there. Well, he finally gets his opportunity in the early 60s when Arnold Johnson, the former owner of the Kansas City Athletics, passes on, and his widow doesn't want to hold on to the team anymore. So there's a free-for-all as people are trying to buy into the Kansas City Athletics. Now, Johnson was a very close friend with a lot of the owners of the New York Yankees at the time, and that is how he got approved to buy the Philadelphia Athletics and move them to Kansas City in 1955. He had the backing of the New York Yankees, and what do you know? The A's were essentially a farm club for the Yankees for many years. Basically, the top players of the A's got traded to the Yankees, including guys like Roger Maris, Don Larson as well. So top players from the Athletics, they just kind of, you know, that was almost like a 4A team, and then they got graduated to the Yankees year in and year out. So Johnson dies, and Finley buys the team in, I believe it was 1962, and he takes over the whole operation. And he very quickly realizes it's not a really good operation there. First of all, because the Yankees were essentially a farm club, or excuse me, the A's were essentially a farm club for the Yankees. So the talent pool was pretty thin. Also, Municipal Stadium, which had been rebuilt about 10 years before, specifically for the relocation of a team to Kansas City, it was not state-of-the-art. It was basically a quote-unquote new stadium on an old stadium footprint. And Municipal Stadium was basically on the footprint of old Muehlbach Stadium, which went back to, I believe, the early 1930s. So it was kind of an outdated stadium. Kansas City was a small market. And also, Kansas City was kind of stuck in the middle of nowhere. No disrespect to anybody who's listening to us in Kansas City. But you know, you had the old west of Major League Baseball, that being St. Louis and Chicago and Cincinnati, and then the new glamorous west of Major League Baseball, which was Los Angeles and San Francisco. Well, here you have Kansas City. It's just right there, right in the heart of the Midwest. Nothing really glamorous about it. Not really a big, shiny market. Still kind of an old west town back in the 1950s and 60s. So as soon as Charlie Finley bought the Athletics, he was looking to get them the hell out of town. So even though his staff was able to mine the countryside for some great ball players, you know, Reggie Jackson got into their system, Jim Hunter, Raleigh Fingers, you know, basically the core of the Oakland A's dominance in the early 1970s. A lot of those seeds were planted in the mid-1960s. And even though he brought a lot of attention to the team with the flashy green and gold jerseys, with the Charlie O. the Mule as the unofficial mascot of the A's, you had the mechanical rabbit that delivered baseballs to umpires at Municipal Stadium. Even though he was doing a lot of all these quirky, innovative things, he wants out of Kansas City. So time and time again, he tries to move the team, and the American League won't let him. He tries to move the team to Louisville, Kentucky. He tried to move them to Oakland back in, I believe, 1964, 1965. He tried to move them to Dallas. He tried to move them to San Antonio, and he just keeps getting turned down time and time again. Well, after the 1967 season, the team's lease with Municipal Stadium expires. He's able to force his way out to Oakland, and that's that. So Joe Cronin, who was the president of the American League, after battling Charlie Finley over and over and over again, and after the American League owners finally relinquish this battle, and I think partially they didn't mind because they knew that the San Francisco-Oakland area couldn't support two professional teams. And that's something that's been going on for the last 50 years. You know, over the last 50 years, the A's have threatened to move. The Giants have threatened to move. In fact, the A's and the Giants both threatened to move at the same time in 1976 in what could have been a wild exchange of, the A's moving to Chicago, with the White Sox moving to Toronto, the Giants moving to Seattle. I mean, there's a whole lot of scenarios where you could have been without baseball in both San Francisco and Oakland at one point in time. So, the owners relinquish. Joe Cronin relinquishes, and finally they're just like, okay, well, this is done, and we're going to just move on from here. Well, that news didn't settle in real well with the mayor of Kansas City. His name was Ilas Davis, and a Missouri senator named Stuart Symington. So Cronin had planned on expanding the American League in 1971. However, Davis and Symington, upon hearing word that Finley's just going to pack up the team and go, well, they protest, and they start talking about challenging the reserve clause, which was a very big deal. Think, this is back when Kurt Flood started doing it, challenging the reserve clause. So basically opening up the possibility of free agency and higher salaries. Owners don't want that to happen. Also, reviewing baseball's antitrust exemption with the IRS. All of a sudden, when you talk antitrust, things get done in Major League Baseball. That was a very popular weapon back in the late 80s and early 90s with all the labor unrest. So Joe Cronin and the American League, and then Major League Baseball on top of it, decide, okay, we'll make everything better by moving up the expansion to 1969. And then all of a sudden, Major League Baseball has to fast track everything and opening up four teams. Yikes. You're expanding the talent pool, but you're thinning it out too. And then you have, teams that were playing in places that you thought on paper made sense, but they didn't really make sense. So Kansas City comes in with the Royals, basically to placate the politicians who were upset that the A's left. Well, the American League's other entry turns out to be Seattle, Washington, the Seattle Pilots. Seattle, an old, tried and true Pacific Coast League city. To counter the Seattle edition, the National League adds the San Diego Padres. So now, through the relocation of the Dodgers and the Giants, with the relocation of the A's, of course, Oakland, a longtime PCL city, with the Oakland Oaks, and now expansion teams in Seattle and San Diego, by 1969, the Major League Baseball owners have basically just driven the nail in the coffin of the Pacific Coast League's host of ever becoming a true major league, something they were in a position to do about 15 years earlier. Well, now they're pretty much done. And then the National League decides to go international with an expansion team in Montreal. Well, as any baseball historian knows, of these four teams, ironically, the city that forced Major League Baseball's hand to speed up the expansion process, Kansas City, they become the most successful of the four teams as the Royals slowly but surely move their way up. They get a beautiful ballpark in what is now Kauffman Stadium, named after their original owner, Ewing Kauffman, who was a fine gentleman who really had his act together, had his financial act together, being able to move them into what was called Royal Stadium and again is now Kauffman Stadium. Well, the Royals, they win the American League West in 1976 and 1977. 1980, they get the American League pennant. They win the World Series in 1985. And, of course, go through some very, very tough years before winning the World Series in 2015. That is, after they won the American League pennant in 2014. As for the other teams, the fortunes are not so good. You have the San Diego Padres really struggle with ownership and money and fan support. Finally make their way to the World Series in 1984. They would do it again in 1998. Have not been to the World Series since. Have not won a World Series. The Expos, we all know about them. They ran into ownership and financial troubles right out of the gate. In fact, almost lost the franchise rights before they even played a game, but they were able to settle things down there. They had a boondoggle of a stadium build in Olympic Stadium. They got stuck in Jarry Park for seven seasons, and we all know where the Expos went. They had a very successful stretch in the late 70s and early 80s. couldn't quite compete afterwards and relocated to Washington, D.C. in 2005. But wait, there's an even more sad sack team, the Seattle Pilots, who were playing in the appropriately named Six Stadium. That's S-I-C-K apostrophe S, named after a former owner of the Seattle Rainiers. Well, Six Stadium was a Depression-era project, and it was a pretty depressing place to play in. If you've read Jim Boughton's Ball 4, you know all about the Seattle Pilots and just how they were completely dysfunctional from top to bottom. And they moved to Milwaukee, Bud Selig buying them right before the start of the 1970 season. So the Pilots have the rather ignominious fame of being the only team in Major League Baseball to last exactly one season before moving. You did have a team, the Baltimore Orioles, lasted just a couple years before they moved to New York. The original Milwaukee Brewers lasted a couple years before they moved to St. Louis. But Seattle, the only team, the Seattle Pilots, the only team to last one season in one city before packing up and moving on to Milwaukee. And of course, the Brewers have been in only one World Series. They didn't really experience their pinnacle until the late 70s and early 80s. They've struggled quite a bit since then, and a lot of fans are still hanging on to that one 1982 season where they took the Cardinals to seven games, but the Cardinals ended up being 1982 World Champions. So that's the backstory of the wild and crazy 1969 expansion, and that is a big influence on Topps' somewhat lackluster set from 1969. But there are some good things about it. Let's take a look at our random poll card number 512. Cleon Jones, looking pretty good here in the almost full frame picture here, as very reminiscent to 67 Topps, takes up pretty much the entire front of the card here. You do have a white border, but most of it is this kind of rounded insert frame. You have a full color picture, and I like the photo quality, the color quality better than 67 Topps. Topps had a better photo processing, I guess, in 1969. The pictures are a little clearer, a little more crisper, a little more real life, while some of the pictures in 1967 Topps are a little rough around the edges, to put it nicely. Much like the 67 Topps set as well, the player's team is located or listed at the bottom of the card. And much like 67 Topps, the player's name and position are up at the top of the card. Now, the biggest difference is, as opposed to 67 Topps, where the name and the position are listed in a horizontal row at the top of the card, they are located inside what I call the price check sticker, or the garage sale price sticker, which you saw in 68 Topps. So in 68 Topps, where the team name was in a colored circle, which does look like a garage sale sticker, this time the player's name and position is in there. And the stickers, or the circles, were color coordinated, not necessarily in line with the team colors. For example, this Cleon Jones card, you're thinking Mets, well, it should be dark blue or orange, while they have purple and gold. So you had some contrasting colors here, but they were consistent from team to team. You know, it wasn't just a mixed bag here. You know, each team had its assigned colors for the circle there. Now, one other interesting note that I should have pointed out in the 68 Topps podcast, I didn't get around to it, but there was at the time, at least from all the research that I've done, there was a time where the Houston Astros were dealing with a copyright issue with the Monsanto company, the company that made AstroTurf. Now, the Astros, and we discussed this in the 64 Topps podcast, when they changed their name from the Colt 45s to the Astros, they went with Astros because it fit in with the space theme of the mid-1960s. You have the NASA base in Houston. So it was a very, you know, not coincidental pairing of taking the space race and the connection with NASA and renaming the ballpark, or renaming the ball team after the whole space program. And that's what happened eventually with the Dome. What was originally called the Harris County Domed Stadium was just simply known as the Astro Dome. And the artificial turf that they used starting in the 1966 season was officially named AstroTurf. Well, the Monsanto people apparently thought that the Astros were taking a little too much advantage of this name and vice versa. So in 68 and 69 tops, you will notice the players who play for the Astros, it does not say Astros on their cards. It just says Houston. And this is something I didn't realize until a couple of years ago when I had that lot of 68 tops cards I talked about in the last podcast. I didn't notice this until then. So in 68 and 69 tops alone, you don't see a card that says Astros. It just says Houston. Now, the Astro logos and the cap insignias are represented on there. So it's not like they completely tried to blot them out from history. But clearly, the Topps company not wanting to get involved in the ongoing litigation between the Houston Astros ball club and the Monsanto company. So for a couple of years, they just put Houston on the card as opposed to Astros. So you have this very basic design to the 69 Topps set. Like I said, it took a lot of elements of 67 and 68 Topps and kind of mashed them together. And they did it out of necessity because, again, of the 69 expansion, they couldn't go crazy with logos, really couldn't go crazy with names, couldn't go crazy with colors. And, of course, the pictures of the players who were selected in the expansion draft. In the first couple of series of cards of the 69 set, you have a lot of pictures of guys without their hats on, or you have that, you know, strange angle of a guy, you know, close-up shot, but underneath the bill of his hat, so kind of looking from the chin up. And then there are some player photographs that were just simply airbrushed out. And again, you know, Topps didn't know what some of these logos were going to look like. So a lot of expansion players, if they have a hat on, just their current team logo was just blotted out. Now, you do see in later series of cards, or in the later series of the sets, players involved with these expansion teams, you do see them in their uniforms, and you also see a lot of palm trees, as you had naturally the Expos and Royals were training in Florida, and the Padres and Pilots were training out in Arizona. But you do get to see them in these uniforms from spring training, and what's also unique is you also see the subtle difference in the Seattle Pilots spring training uniforms. They had a very plain uniform, and then you had the full Pilots uniform in the regular season where you had the old scrambled egg kind of look on the bill of the cap, and just a couple of subtle differences. So if you're big on uniform history, you can definitely see that in the later series of the 69 Topps set as opposed to series 1 and 2. So again, out of necessity, Topps has to go this way, but out of creativity, it's just not very creative. Now, with that said, I do like 69 Topps better than, say, 67 or 61, because even though it is very plain and simple, I think one of the key things to the design on the front is the quality of the photography. Again, the colors are just a little more vibrant. They're a little more clearer, a little more crisper. A lot of these pictures just look so much better than certainly 67 Topps, which, like I said, had kind of that grainy look to some of the pictures, and 61 Topps, where a lot of the pictures just were dark for some kind of reason. So again, it's a good set, but not a great set because of the lack of design features. And again, part of it is out of necessity, but Topps really just took a lot of the elements from 67 and 68 and just kind of put them in a blender here. Now, one thing that really helps the 69 Topps set is the back of the card. So if you flip the card over, and you can see in the picture here, one thing that really stands out about 69 Topps, it's the color scheme. It is bright pink. But, you know, it's not a girly pink. You know, it's not a Barbie doll pink. I think it's actually a rather appropriate color pink for Topps, because what was Topps really selling back then? Chewing gum. You know, the Bazooka Joe brand chewing gum. And that was still the main thing, you know, that helped them have this monopoly in sports cards. You know, if you look at the wrappers for a lot of these older card sets, it wasn't Topps baseball cards. It was Topps chewing gum with picture cards. That's how it was advertised. So having the bubblegum colored back to the card, I think, is actually pretty cool. And there is actually something very striking and pretty artistic in this bright pink and black combination on top of the white cardstock. I don't think you could pull this off if it had the gray cardstock, but it's very easy to read. And to borrow a term from this time, it's very mod. It's got a really good look to it. And if we look at this card, you'll see the Topps logo, which was in use a couple years before, but not really in use on the cards. And that is the now infamous logo, where you have the lowercase t, where the tail of the t curves underneath the OPPS of the card. And, you know, speaking of artistic, they're able to curve that t underneath a little circle with the card number. That was very well done. Very small box with personal information, a lot of room on the right upper hand corner with a cartoon factoid, a little bit of a biography if space permitted underneath the card number and personal information box, and then you have the complete major and minor league record for the player. And again, it looks very sharp with the black text on the white stock surrounded by the bright pink color here. And this is also, I should mention, when Topps went back to the horizontal presentation. You know, they went vertical in 1967 and 68, would go horizontal once again, and they would do so up until 1973. 73, they went vertical and then would continue horizontal from then on, from 74 till 92, I believe. And some cards in 72 had a vertical presentation, but I think most of them were horizontal. So one of the things that saves the overall design of 69 Topps is this very mod, very bright, you can't miss it, but very easy to read color scheme and design on the back of the card. I think that's really one of my favorite aspects of the 69 Topps card, is not necessarily the fronts of the cards, but the backs of the card. And like I said, because, you know, with these older cards, and you typically had that wax slash gum slash cardboard smell, having that bubblegum look to it was actually kind of neat. I don't know if Topps actually intended on having a bubblegum look, but it just kind of played off that way, and it looks really, really sharp. Now, also looking sharp for this particular card is one Cleon Jones, our random pull, a guy who had a pretty average career across the board. I mean, he had some pretty good seasons, but you look at his career numbers, 281 batting average, pretty good, 93 home runs, all right. Just under 1,200 hits, 1,196 hits in a 13-year career. Not bad. What we would call a very serviceable career, an all-star in 1969. And he had a pretty good stretch of seasons where he was a regular with the Mets from 1966 through 1974. Had an injury-plagued 73 season, but for the most part appeared in an average of, 120, 130 games throughout that stretch of time. But 1969 would be a very magical season for Cleon Jones, as it would for the New York Mets. And Cleon Jones comes out of Mobile, Alabama, a hotbed for a lot of talent in Major League Baseball, specifically Plateau, Alabama. But coming through Mobile, you, of course, had Hank Aaron, you had Willie Mays, you had a lot of great players that came out through Mobile. So he signs with the Mets as an amateur free agent in 1963, works his way up through the system, and becomes a regular outfielder with the team starting in 1966. And like I said, had a pretty average career, you know, 275 in 66, 246 in 67. Pretty impressive 297 in 1968. And what really makes it impressive is he had a dreadful first half to the 68 season, but with a little tutelage under Gil Hodges, was able to go on this tear during the second half of the season, and it carried over into the 1969 season. Listen to these numbers. A 340 batting average. He had 12 home runs that year, 75 RBI, 25 doubles, 4 triples, 164 hits, and an OPS of 904. He was actually in the MVP race that year. He finished a distant 7th, but again, to be in that race is pretty notable. And as I said, he did represent the Mets at the 1969 National League All-Star Game. Now, the bigger story, though, with Cleon Jones in 1969 are three particular moments that kind of encapsulated the 69 season for the Mets. First of all, we start on July 30th, 1969. The Houston Astros are in town, and the Mets are just getting absolutely clobbered in a doubleheader. They lost the first game 16-3, and then they're losing the second game 7-0 in the third inning. Now, Johnny Edwards, a catcher for the Astros, hits a double into left field. And there's all sorts of different stories about this particular play. But Gil Hodges comes out of the dugout, and people are thinking, okay, he's making a pitching change. Nolan Ryan, by the way, on the mound at this time. But Hodges goes past Ryan, and he just keeps walking out into left field. And he's talking to Cleon Jones. And then both Hodges and Jones are walking back to the dugout. And Ron Swoboda goes out to left field to replace him. Now, there are all sorts of different stories and different angles. At the time, it was reported that Jones had suffered a leg injury. It had been raining a lot, so Shea Stadium's field was a little swampy, to put it nicely. So there was a thought that Jones had tweaked something, and it was just an injury precaution that Swoboda came in. Well, later on, the story got out that Hodges wanted to punish Jones. He felt that Jones was not, playing at 100% out there. He wasn't hustling. So he decided to show him up in front of the home crowd and pull him out right in the middle of the game. Now, again, there's a lot of different stories here. According to Gil Hodges' widow, and Hodges passed away in 1972, so nobody really knows his full story on this. But Hodges just started walking out, and, once he got past the pitcher's mound, he just kept walking. It was almost like he was in a daze, just kept walking, and then he realized, well, I'm out in the outfield, I might as well do something, and he pulled Jones then. And even Jones disputes the whole I was being shown up thing, and he says that Hodges came out to him and just kind of said, something along the lines of, boy, this is a tough game, hey, why don't you come in, and that was that. So nobody really knows the true story. Nobody knows the full story. Of course, in today's day and age, we would know the whole story on Twitter by the sixth inning. But a lot of, I wouldn't even say he said, she said. It's just so many different sources. Nobody's really sure what happened. Was Jones injured? Was he being shown up for not hustling? Was Hodges just in a daze, after getting hammered in the first game, and here they are getting hammered again in the second game? Nobody knows. But what they do know is after this particular incident, whatever message was or wasn't being sent by Hodges to his team, it was received. And all of a sudden, the Mets go on a tear. They win 38 of their last 50 games. They finish the season with a 162 record. And that's a far cry of their 42 wins and 120 loss record in their first year in 1962. And, all of a sudden the Mets win the division. They beat the Cubs. They win the division by 8 games over the Cubs. And all of a sudden the Mets are just rolling into the National League Championship Series. Jones has an incredible series. Now, this was a best-of-5 series back then. In the 3 games that he played in, he bats .429 and just has a phenomenal series. So that was incident number one, the doubleheader on July 30th. Well, then he's involved incident number two, and this was a legendary incident in Game 5. The Mets are up 3-1, and Cleon Jones is up to bat. Dave McNally hits Jones with a pitch. He hits him in the foot, and Jones drops his bat, turns around, starts trotting over to first base. Well, Lou DeMuro was the home plate umpire. He says, hey, get back here. And DeMuro is arguing with Jones that he got hit with a pitch. And Jones is like, he hit me in the foot. And DeMuro's like, no, you didn't. Get back into the box. Well, Hodges comes out from the dugout, and it turns out that the ball that hit Jones went back into the Mets dugout. So Hodges has the ball, and he points to a black smudge that's on the baseball, and the black smudge is shoe polish. This is back in the day when baseball players' shoes were not Nike or Adidas or Reebok or whatever. They were actual leather shoes, and you polished the shoes. Where maybe the players didn't, but you would have a clubhouse attendant who would. So Jones had this smudge of shoe polish or Hodges has this smudge of shoe polish that comes off of Jones' shoe, and he's showing DeMuro, it's like, hey, you know, you got the call wrong. You got hit by the pitch here. So DeMuro actually changes the call. Okay, you go to first base. Well, later, Don Clendenin, who was the next hitter, hits a two-run home run. So the Mets are now just a run down. Al Weiss later hits a solo home run. Jones then leads off the eighth inning with a double that is almost a home run. He would score when Ron Sobota hit a double a little later on down in the inning. The Mets would win the World Series 5-3. And who catches the series-ending hit? A fly ball off the bat of Davey Johnson. You guessed it. Cleon Jones, and it was a ball that was carrying. It almost went out of the park, but Jones catches the ball, drops down to one knee. Shea Stadium goes nuts, and there you go. And Jones would continue to be a Met, had a pretty successful 70, 71, and 72 season. In 73, he slumped a bit, was dealing with some injuries too, but had a pretty memorable season, as did the Mets in their amazing run up through the National League Division Series with Cincinnati. They would lose the World Series against Oakland, but Jones had a pretty good World Series that year, hitting .286 in the, seven-game series against the A's. And then his career starts going downhill. He was dealing with a knee injury in 1975, was going through extended spring training with the Mets, and has a little run-in with the law. 5 a.m. on May the 4th. Nothing good's happening at 5 a.m. unless you're just waking up. Well, that was kind of the situation for Jones. He was found asleep in a van with a 21-year-old woman. And Jones claims, well, I have no idea who this woman is. And well, I just decided to give her a ride home in a friend's borrowed van, and it ran out of gas and I fell asleep. And then I woke up and, you know, I'm not wearing any clothes. And, you know, this lady's got some marijuana on her. So it was a very fishy story. So Jones was charged with indecent exposure. He was publicly humiliated by the chairman of the Mets, Donald Grant. He was fined $2,000, which in 1975 is a pretty big amount. But when I say he was embarrassed, it wasn't just cash. He had to publicly apologize for the incident during a press conference with his wife by his side. So you talk about being humbled. By the way, they're still together, he and his wife, which is a pretty amazing thing there. Anyways, he was picked up by the Chicago White Sox in 1976, only played a handful of games in the 76 season, and that was it. Even though offensively he is not most well known for his talents, defensively the guy had an absolute cannon of an arm, made some very memorable plays, including in the 1973 season. Ask any longtime Mets fan, they can tell you about the legendary ball on the wall play where he made an incredible catch and throw to comeback attempt. I believe it was the Pittsburgh Pirates in that game. As for what is he doing nowadays? Well, like many other 69 Mets, he has managed to work his way into an episode of Everybody Loves Raymond, and he is still doing alumni appearances, also showing up at the anniversary games, you know, after the 40th anniversary or the 45th anniversary of the 69 World Series. He is still all around Shea Stadium, City Field, excuse me, and still very much a part of the Mets scene. Even though his career did not end well with the Mets, not only the arrest, but also he had a lot of run-ins with Yogi Berra, then the manager of the Mets. Even though it didn't end well, he's been a big part of the Mets organization in terms of an alumni status for many, many years. So there you go, Cleon Jones, a big part and very symbolic of the Mets' 69 World Series championship. On the less than perfect and not really great, but good enough 69 top set, in my opinion, better seen for the backs than the fronts of cards, although the fronts are not offensive. They're just not very innovative or all that exciting. Now, I would say, though, if you have a chance to buy a lot of 69 Topps cards, by all means, go for it. There are some pretty good cards in here, and especially if you're a fan of the history of baseball, you've got some really good players. You also have those expansion teams. If you want to see the first players for a lot of those expansion teams, they're in that set. And if you're looking for the first look of them in their new uniforms, look for the higher series cards as opposed to some of the lower series cards where the top set kind of dance around some of the pictures just to make it work. Now, you will find plenty of 69 Topps cards, as this was a 664 card set. And there are a couple notable rookie cards in here. Reggie Jackson, the biggest one, but also Raleigh Fingers as well. Craig Nettles in here too. So some pretty notable names. And a set that's fairly easy to get your hands on for being almost 40 years old. So again, if you can find it through your local card shop or through an auction site, whatever the case may be, 69 Topps, even though it is good but not great, I think it's something where having a handful for your own collection is certainly beneficial for you, and something that you can do affordably. You can get cards from 1969 on average, regardless of condition, probably about a quarter a piece. So it's not all that hard to get a starter set or even a collection of, 100 or so cards. You can get for $20, $25, depending on where you're buying them. Well, that's our look at the 69 top set, Cleon Jones, our random pull, a little bit of history with the 69 Major League expansion, and of course, the conversation on wax and gum stains. We've got the 77 tops that'll be going up for auction there later this week. A whole lot of fun things to digest from this episode. Now, as for our next episode, the new episode, that'll be a week from this Tuesday. We'll take a look at the 1970 top set, which is rather businesslike, but really not that creative. Tops ending the 60s on a rather lackluster effort, just kind of with a whimper and not with a bang. And starting the 70s off with a rather conservative set. 1970 Topps will go in the books as another good but not great set. But the good news is, as you will see over the next few weeks as we go through the big old binder, Topps would finally get inspired to get a little creative, not only in designs, but in photography as well, starting in 1971. But we have to look at the rather blah and gray 1970 top set. We'll do that with our next new podcast. Also be on the lookout for that Flashback Friday podcast as we give you a chance to look through some of our older episodes. And don't forget, you can always listen to new and archived episodes of Wax Ecstatic via Audio Boom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and Stitcher. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Thank you so much for listening to Wax Ecstatic. We'll see you next week.